is RaceNetRadio.com. RaceNetRadio.com.
Welcome to Vocal Point on GraceNetRadio.com. Each week, we will examine issues that concern all Christians living in today's culture. Politics, theology, world affairs, citizenship, ethics, and personal responsibility. And now, your host of Vocal Point, Jerry Newcomb on GraceNetRadio.com.
Wow, what a privilege we have today. We have Dr. Stephen Meyer on the line here. He's the author of a brand new book called Darwin's Doubt. The subtitle is so creative if you're familiar with this topic. It is The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. By the way, Dr. Meyer is the author of the best-selling book, which got a lot of attention in 2009, Signature in the Cell. In fact, we talked with him at the time the book came out. Dr. Meyer, welcome to the program, and let me commend you and congratulate you for getting this published by Harper One. I mean, to have a book that promotes intelligent design get out there and be published by a major secular publisher is quite a coup. Congratulations, and I'm glad you're on our side, quite frankly.
Well, thank you very much. The people at Harper have been great. I've got a fantastic editor, and it's been quite a wild ride, actually. So, yeah, thank you.
Now, we are broadcasting here from South Florida all around to the world through the Internet and so forth. But you come down sometimes to the Palm Beach Atlantic School, I believe.
Well, I did a little teaching at Palm Beach Atlantic for a while, but I've been down for conferences in Tampa and other places, so I'm familiar with South Florida, and I love it.
All right. Tell us about this new book. This is obviously about the fossil record and how the fossil record essentially shows when Darwin said, hey, look, my theory will or will not be vindicated by what is yet to be found in the fossil record. For now, it doesn't look very good, but hopefully it'll look better. But it seems as if 150 or so years later, the missing links are still missing.
Well, the topic of the book, the title tells the story. It's I tell the story of a doubt that Darwin had about his own theory. And it was the doubt that he had was about an event in the history of life that's known as the Cambrian Explosion. And the Cambrian Explosion refers to the geologically sudden or abrupt appearance of the major groups of animals early in the fossil record in a period of time that geologists call the Cambrian. And Darwin was aware of this problem, and he understood that it was a challenge to his theory, because he anticipated that the mechanism of natural selection acting on random variations would have to work very slowly and gradually. He thought that the variations would be slow, minute, and incremental. If they were big, the mechanism would generate deformities that would not survive. So he thought that the mechanism needed to generate small incremental variations, and that would take a lot of time. And yet what we see in the fossil record is the abrupt appearance of these animal forms. Mm-hmm. He knew of some of them in his time, but he anticipated or hoped that subsequent generations of fossil hunters and paleontologists would discover the ancestral precursors to these animal forms in the lower Precambrian layers. In fact, what's happened is that more and more Cambrian animals have been discovered, each of which, or most of which, have still lack these ancestral forms. And so we have this pattern of very abrupt, discontinuous appearance in contrast to the picture of the history of life that Darwin drew of a slow, gradual unfolding of life. And so he was aware of the problem. What the book does is it tells the story mm-hmm. of that doubt and how it's grown up to become an even deeper problem, not just in paleontology, not just with the fossils, but there's a deeper engineering problem, if you will, the problem of building animals. How would the Darwinian mechanism build things this complex in the time allowed by the fossil record, or even in a much greater expanse of time?
Now, your book has illustrations, and you have, for example, an illustration from Darwin himself or from his original book showing the tree of life. And so explain to us this tree of life illustration, and then explain to us how the Cambrian explosion basically discounts that tree of life illustration.
Right, that's the other aspect. The Cambrian explosion contradicted Darwin's proposed mechanism of natural selection because it had to act slow and gradually. But that mechanism, if played out, Darwin thought, would generate something like a branching tree. That was his depiction of the history of life. All the terminal branches on the branching tree represent the forms of life we see today. The trunk of the tree represents, in his thinking, the simplest, probably one-celled organism. And then all the other branches connecting the trunk to the terminal branches are the intermediate forms. What's missing in the fossil record of the Cambrian explosion are those intermediate forms, those ancestral precursors. And that was another reason that Darwin recognized that the Cambrian was, as he put it, a valid objection to the views here entertained. He was very honest about the problems that he understood his theory had and the things that it couldn't explain. And this was perhaps, I think definitely, the principal thing that bothered him. What I show in the book is that mystery surrounding the Cambrian has grown up to be illustrative of a major crisis in evolutionary biology, because it's not just a matter of the missing fossils. It's this deeper problem of coming up with a mechanism that can explain complex animal life, especially in the wake of all the things we've discovered in the last 50 or 60 years in biology about the importance of information, digital code, and other forms of information that are stored in DNA and elsewhere in the cell. It's just like in computer science. If you want to have a new function on your computer, you've got to have lots of code, lots of instructions.
Mm-hmm.
You want to build these complex animal forms, we now know you need information, you need instructions, and that's the crucial question that is really creating an impasse in evolutionary theory. Where does that information come from?
Well, in the beginning was the word. But, I mean, that's my perspective, and that's where I'm coming from. Now, you studied at Cambridge. Cambridge. You earned your PhD at Cambridge. By the way, where does that word Cambria come from? I didn't even know there was a Cambria, California, until we visited there recently to see San Simeon, to see the Hearst Castle, which is a fantastic
site. It was the name of the fossil strata in Wales. During the 19th century, Darwin was aware of the Cambrian fossils primarily from that Wales find, and so that it became known as the Cambrian or Cambrian explosion.
All right, now let me ask a dumb question. What if somebody said to you, hey, or maybe it's not a dumb question. What if somebody said to you, Dr. Meyer, is it possible that what you have in the Cambrian explosion is basically, since 98% or so of organisms that die never fossilize, and instead fossils have to basically, you have to be trapped quickly, like in a mud sediment or something like that, sediment, to be fossilized. Is it possible that the Cambrian explosion is basically the flood of Noah?
I think I know of some young Earth geologists who might think that. I'm not sure how that correlates. Certainly most evolutionary biologists aren't open to that at all. I don't really get into the question of the age of the Earth, but rather the pattern of fossilization. And what you often have people say in response to my argument is to say, well, kind of as you were saying, fossilization is rare. The missing ancestors are really an artifact of incomplete sampling of the fossil record, and therefore there's not really an explosion. It's just the appearance of an explosive event. But there's been some amazing discoveries in southern China that I think have put that approach to bed, because what has been discovered in southern China is another major Cambrian find, exquisitely preserved animals, and they've even documented now the presence of fishes in the earliest these earliest strata documenting the explosion of animal life. But in the lower layers, in the pre-Cambrian, some Chinese paleontologists have discovered soft-tissued microscopic embryo fossils, embryos of sponges. And it raises a huge question. If you can preserve a soft-tissued embryo fossil, why aren't you preserving the alleged ancestors of all these other animals that first appear in the Cambrian period?
Ah.
And so it's really a decisive refutation of what's known as the artifact hypothesis, the idea that we're not finding the ancestors because it's an artifact of incomplete sampling or incomplete preservation in the fossil record. So I think that idea has gone by the way.
Isn't that interesting? All right, we're talking right now with Dr. Stephen Meyer, a New York Times best-selling author. His newest book is Darwin's Doubt, and the subtitle is The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. Why, by the way, I think that subtitle is so clever, as is the title, but play or explain to us the play on words here with that word explosive.
Well, the event in the history of life that caused Darwin to doubt was known as the Cambrian explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And the origin of the animal forms really is explosive. As you move up the rock column, you find nothing like these animal forms, and then boom, there they are. And the second part of the subtitle has to do with the positive case for intelligent design. The book makes a critique of the Darwinian mechanism and shows that the Darwinian mechanism is not capable of generating the reams and reams of digital code that's necessary to build these new animals. But I also show that when we encounter information, especially in a digital form, whether we're looking at a hieroglyphic inscription or a section of computer code or a headline in a book or even information embedded in a radio signal, and we trace that information back to its source, we always come to a mind, not a material process.
Mm.
And the Cambrian explosion is not just an explosion of new biological form and structure. It's not just an explosion of new forms of life. It's actually an explosion of the information that's necessary to produce those forms of life. And so I argue that that feature of living, of animal life, the intense presence of information is a decisive indicator of prior intelligent design, of a purposive intelligence
mm-hmm.
playing a role in the history of life.
Now, when you talk about the Cambrian explosion, there's no secret here. I mean, for example, Time magazine had a cover story about 10 or 15 years ago, biology's Big Bang. That's what they called the Cambrian explosion. And so let me ask you a question. If we had, let's say, 100% of those who would claim today to be Darwinists, 100%, how many of them would be pure Darwinists in the sense that they would say, look, what Darwin explains and the way he explains it in the on the origins of the species, that's the way I take it, as opposed to neo-Darwinists or some sort of variation of. So you understand the question?
Well, neo-Darwinism today would be the standard textbook version of evolutionary theory.
Okay.
It replaces Darwin's idea of natural selection acting on random variations with the idea that many of those variations are mutations in genetic material. But that itself poses a problem, because if you recognize that, as we now do, that genes are very much like a section of software or a piece of software code. Bill Gates, in fact, says that DNA is like a software code, only much more complex than any that's ever been created. Richard
yeah.
Dawkins says that the genes are uncannily like a machine code. And instead of zeros and ones, the genetic text is written with four chemicals
mm-hmm.
called bases that chemists represent with the letters A, T, G, and C. So the bases actually function like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in machine code. And if you think about the Darwinian mechanism, a mutation acting on a section of code, then ask yourself this. Just take the computer example. If you take a section of computer code and start randomly changing the zeros and ones, are you more likely to degrade the information that's
yes.
present there, or to build a new section of software, a new program or operating system?
No.
You know, obviously you're more likely to degrade. And in the book I show that this problem is really deep and profound, and there's a mathematical probabilistic element to it. The improbability of generating a new gene from a pre-existing gene is astronomically small. And renders this neo-Darwinian mechanism implausible on that grounds, as well as many others that I investigate in the book. And so that really leaves, and this gets back to your question, it has left many evolutionary biologists now searching for a new theory of evolution. And in the book, I look at six theories that have been proposed in recent years that are, in a sense, post-neo-Darwinian theories. They've been proposed since the establishment of neo-Darwinism as a standard textbook version of evolution. And that alone, I think, shows the ferment in the field and also the depth of the problems with the standard approach. So I would say that while most evolutionary theorists still are committed to finding a completely materialistic or naturalistic solution to the problem of biological origins, including this big problem of the origin of biological form and information, the very fact that there are so many different theories being proposed shows that there really is no consensus about how any of this really happened. And it's into that mix that I propose the theory of intelligent design is a better theory, a better explanation for the origin of the key things that need to be explained in the history of life, including this fascinating importance of digital code and information in these explosions that you see when you see new forms of life arising so abruptly in the fossil record.
So then virtually no scientists of today would take Darwin completely at face value. I mean, even those who were dyed-in-the-wool evolutionists, they would be neo-Darwinists at best.
Yeah, the neo-Darwinism is kind of the modern form of Darwin's theory, and that's the orthodox theory. It's thought to be very much in the train of Darwinian thought.
Mm-hmm.
But there are theories today of evolution that are getting rid of the idea of natural selection or minimizing its impact, looking for new mechanisms, because it's widely understood that the mechanism of natural selection acting on random mutations does not have the creative power that has long been attributed to it, and certainly it doesn't have the creative power necessary to account for the origin of fundamentally new forms of animal life, such as arise in the Cambrian period. And so one scientist put it this way. He said that the mutation selection mechanism explains the survival but not the arrival of the fittest. The origin of fundamentally new forms of life is something that many evolutionary biologists are acknowledging has not been adequately explained. Thus, the formulation of these new theories attempting to do that. I explain and critique those theories in the book and show that while many of them do have advantages over the standard textbook view of neo-Darwinism, they also uniformly fail to account for the origin of the information that's necessary to build animal life in the first place. And so there's a fundamental and very big unanswered question in evolutionary biology, and that's why I think intelligent design has a lot to offer.
All right, we're talking right now with Stephen Meyer, author of the book Darwin's Doubt, subtitled The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design, and it is a bestseller, a New York Times bestseller, no less. And again, I commend you for that, Stephen, for being out there in the highway and byways and the marketplace of ideas with such an important, important message. Okay,
great to talk with you, too. I've enjoyed our conversations in the past and your interest in the topic, because it's a topic that is scientific, but it also has larger worldview implications.
Totally.
Because every worldview has to answer this basic question of origins, or what James Sire in his book about worldviews called the prime reality question. What is the thing or the entity or the process from which everything else comes? Darwinism answers that question by reference to a strictly materialistic process, natural selection acting on random mutations. And therefore, it provides an indispensable plank in an overall materialistic conception of the world, because it's answering that prime reality question in materialistic terms. Intelligent design says, no, there's a purpose of intelligence behind this, and therefore, while not itself a proof for God's existence, it has larger, I would say, theistic implications. The great theistic religions, the Judeo-Christian perspective in particular, has been that there's a designing intelligence responsible for what we see. One of the Psalms actually says that in wisdom thou hast created all things.
Mm.
And so intelligent design isn't based on this on scripture or religious authority, but it does affirm tenets of a theistic worldview, and therefore it has theistic-friendly implications.
Sure, that makes sense. Speaking of previous interviews we've done, if you wouldn't mind repeating this soundbite, because it's very memorable, give that analogy about playing Scrabble and the Declaration of Independence.
Well, the central problem of information is that you need to have and I'm talking now from a neo-Darwinian point of view. The mechanism that's said to generate everything is the mechanism of natural selection acting on random mutations. But the problem is, if you are arranging, what you're trying to explain, and we now understand, is digital information. The A's, G's, and T's arranged in very specific ways so that the genetic information will instruct the cell to build the proteins it needs to stay alive. If we begin to think about the problem of generating information by the random arrangement or rearrangement of these characters in the genetic code, it's somewhat similar to taking a bunch of Scrabble letters and picking them out at random and hoping to generate something like the Declaration of Independence. Obviously, that's a hopeless task, and one of the reasons it's hopeless has to do with the probabilities involved, and I go into that in the book. But if you just think about, you know, you might get lucky if you have only to build a very short string of characters like cat or ran or bat or something like that. But the longer the necessary string, the smaller and smaller the odds get. In fact, they grow exponentially smaller with each additional character required. When we consider how long a gene is, you know, on average about 1,000 characters, you've got a lot of information to generate, and it's just not plausible to think that you could do that as a result of an essentially undirected random process that relies heavily on random mutations for the generation of that information.
You know, by the way, every time I log on to my computer, especially if I make a little error with an 8 to 10 character password, if I make one little small stroke, boom, I don't get to log in, and I'm reminded again of how wrong evolution is.
That's true. Good. That's called specificity, and biology is full of specificity, and it makes it very implausible, therefore, to think that an undirected random process of mutation could generate that information.
All right, now let me ask you this. I once interviewed Dr. Francis Collins, and he is, you know, was the co-leader or whatever, the Human Genome Project, and he said a soundbite that I've never forgotten. It's just unbelievable. But he said that if you were to take the human genome sequence, you know, the ATGC, and just literally print it out on paper, single font, 8x11 normal papers, in one human cell, just one, and our bodies are comprised of about 5 trillion cells or so, you would generate so much information that if you were to stack this up into little pieces of paper, 8x11, that those pages would stack as high as the Washington Monument, and you have...
I've heard that illustration. Yeah,
that much information.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
In one cell. By the way, to this day, I wish I had asked him, one side or both sides? But anyway.
Well, I think it's 3 billion base pairs in the human genome, so it's an extraordinary amount of information. People used to think a lot of that was so-called junk DNA, DNA that didn't code for proteins and was the leftover detritus of the failed trial and error process of natural selection acting on all those random mutations. But recent scientific research, including something called the ENCODE project, has shown that those sections of text, of the genetic text that don't code for proteins, are functioning overall as something like an operating system in a computer that is controlling the expression of the other information, the data files. And so the concept of junk DNA is also going by the wayside, and it's something that advocates of intelligent design predicted back in the 90s, that the junk DNA, if our theory is true, would turn out to be importantly functional, and so it has become the case.
Well, the reason I even bring up Dr. Collins, and by the way, that junk DNA, that reminds me of the old vestigial organs thing that, you know, let's say around 1900, they thought certain parts of the human body were just leftovers from evolution, and they had no function and no purpose, and then later they learned, oh, no, there's a reason for this, there's a reason for that. But going back to Dr. Collins, he claims that he believes in evolution, but just that God was the prime mover of it. But I don't know how to square that with my understanding of what you're saying.
Well, I've called publicly for Dr. Collins, who's a brilliant scientist and a good guy, and other people who are proponents of theistic evolution, like the people at the BioLogos Institute that Collins helped started before he left to go to the NIH. Excuse me, to clarify their view on this. You know, is God directing this process or merely standing by and watching an undirected process do the work?
Okay, and we're talking right now with Stephen Meyer, author of the book Darwin's Doubt. And were you finished with that thought?
It's a big issue. You know, Collins has been critical of intelligent design But if he thinks that, that God is directing the process, that's actually a form of intelligent design.
You're right.
So I'm not sure what his objection would be. On the other hand, if God is not directing the process, that's hard to square with a traditional Christian theistic view of things.
You're right.
It sounds more deistic. So I've just wondered exactly what the view is of those who claim to affirm theistic evolution, especially those who are opposed to intelligent design.
All right, let me ask you a question. Now, we've been discussing a little bit about neo-Darwinism and so forth, but where does the views of, let's say, the late Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard or Niles Eldridge fit in? I understand their view was this is very simplistic, but to call it the hopeful monster theory is the idea that, let's say, a bird laid an egg and a reptile popped out, or vice versa. In other words, there was some new creation just in the process of birth. How does that square with the evidence?
Well, Gould did not embrace the hopeful monster theory. His theory was something called punctuated equilibrium.
Right.
Some people accused him of bringing back the idea of these macro mutations, but he was a little more subtle than that. And what he was proposing, and Eldridge as well, is that paleontologists ought to be reading the fossil record more at face value. What we see in the fossil record is the sudden appearance of major groups of animals, and those animals are not explained by the slow-acting mechanism of natural selection. So they said, we need a new theory of evolution, and they called that theory punctuated equilibrium. And the theory had a nice run through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but it's kind of died out within evolutionary biology, because evolutionary biologists have recognized that while it did describe the fossil record more accurately, it never really came up with a mechanism that could account for the amount of change that arises in the fossil record as quickly as it does.
Mm. You know, I once talked myself on the phone years ago with Dr. Colin Patterson. He's now dead. And he was in the British Museum, and I called him here from Fort Lauderdale to actually.
Oh, really?
Ask him.
Yeah, he's a great figure. Yeah.
Yeah, and I asked him to see if there's any way we could get him on a program, and he absolutely declined. I made it clear what this was for D. James Kennedy and stuff, the case for creation, a special we made back in the late 80s. But anyway, I said, Do you stand by the letter that you wrote that's reproduced in so-and-so's book, which basically says that there are no fossils that would stand up in a court of law that show, you know, basically the chronicle evolution in progress? I'm summarizing what he said. He said, I definitely stand by that. And, you know, and then
he made this famous statement. He asked a question, you know, well, what is it, you know, what can we point to that shows us what it is that we actually know about evolution? He said almost nothing, you know.
Right. But this is what he said to me, and I've never forgotten it. He said, don't misunderstand me. I believe in evolution. It's just that we have not been able to find the proper mechanism to show that it's true.
Right. And in the book, that's where I lay the greatest focus. I look at the problem of the fossil record, in particular in relation to the Cambrian explosion. And that problem has become more acute, not less acute, since Darwin's time. More Cambrian forms have been discovered, and almost all of them lack connection to any discernible ancestral precursor in the pre-Cambrian record. But the deeper problem is the problem that Patterson discussed with you, which is the problem of mechanism. Is there any natural mechanism that we can point to that has the capacity to generate the form and the information necessary to produce these animal forms? In the book, I look at five separate problems that afflict the neo-Darwinian mechanism of mutation and selection. One of them is generating the new genetic code, but people have treated mutation as a kind of magic wand in evolutionary biology.
Like a miracle.
Another problem I look at is a fascinating problem called the problem of embryonic lethals. If you want to build a new animal body plan, and that's what arises in the Cambrian, it's not just some new features, but whole new ways of organizing tissues, organs, and body parts. Sounds grisly, but it's the evolutionary terminology is the origin of a body plan. Where do these plans come from? Well, we know that to build a body plan in an existing animal, the cells have to be organized and differentiated from each other in very specific ways. And that process starts very early in the development of an animal, from embryo to adult. which means that if you want to build a new animal form by mutation, the mutations have to occur early in the developmental trajectory of a new animal.
Yes.
But when scientists have done mutation experiments on animals, and they mutate the first few cell divisions, inevitably they don't just get deleterious mutations, harmful mutations, they get dead organisms. It's called the problem of embryonic lethals. And so if that's the case, and you need mutations to act early, if you need an early beneficial body plan mutation, and yet those kinds of mutations never occur, you never get beneficial early acting mutations, you always get dead organisms, how would you ever change one animal body plan into another? And yet that's what we see arising in the Cambrian explosion, is novel body plans. So there's some really profound problems with the mechanism of natural selection and random mutation. And I document those and go into them, explain them in the book.
Wow. Stephen, we're out of time, but I thank you so much for all your labors. I mean, this book, by the way, is huge. This is more than 400, and it's almost 500 pages with footnotes and index and even illustrations, some of which are in color. But again, this is out in the highways and byways. This isn't just some sort of self-published book that sits in a corner somewhere. This is a New York Times best-selling book. Oh, and
well,
there's even a DVD
with
it.
It's a mystery story, so it combined the scientific rigor with also a good story. So I hope, and I do mean it for informed scientific laymen and as well as specialists. So I hope your listeners will find it engaging, because I wrote it with a large popular audience in mind as well.
Yes, and think about all those young people going off to college. This is like the perfect book for a parent or grandparent to put into their hands so that they're armed with the facts before they get this onslaught of, frankly, of misinformation. Thank you so much, Dr. Meyer. Appreciate it.
And thank you, Jerry, for having me on.
Oh,
really,
that's great.
The conversation.
Is there a website for the book, or just?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's darwinsdoubt.com. The book is also available through all the online sellers, sure. Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And it's in Barnes & Noble, the store. They've had some in-store displays across the country about the book.
Oh, that's great. darwinsdoubt.com. Okay, thank you, sir. God bless.
You too. Thank
all
you.
All right, sure. Bye-bye.